Hi, and welcome to the Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the search for emergency housing for several residents of an apartment building in Valparaiso. The Hard Rock Casino is coming to Gary. Brenda Smith reports on Attorney General Curtis Hill's latest attempts to block a federal lawsuit against him. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Donna Stuckard of the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Updates. United Way Network is working to find emergency housing for 9 adults, 7 children, and several animals living in a Valparaiso apartment building that is being shut down due to a cockroach and bedbug infestation. Work with residents began when Porter Regional Hospital alerted United Way of Porter County to the situation on behalf of one of the residents. A health department inspector was called in to evaluate the situation and determine an eviction order was to administered due to the unsafe conditions. In addition to the infestation, the electricity was temporarily shut off to the 6-unit building during the extreme heat this past Saturday. The eviction notice was served earlier this week, giving tenants until Friday, July 26, to leave. United Way is helping with the relocation efforts by coordinating housing and services provided by partners such as Housing Opportunities, Hilltop Neighborhood House, Porter County Agency and Community Services, New Creations Men's Center, Salvation Army, Catholic Charities, Porter County Library, Valparaiso Community Schools, Val Park Animal Hospital, Porter Hospital, Neighbors Place, Health Link, and Neighborhood Link, Porter County. Due to the infestation, residents must leave all possessions behind. United Way is seeking monetary donations to support the resident relocation effort into interim and long-term housing. Monetary donations can be made to the United Way Disaster Relief Fund at unitedwaypc.org or by calling 219-464-3583.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The owner of a Northwest Indiana casino is targeting the end of next year to complete its move from Lake Michigan to an on-land location in Gary. Executives of Indianapolis-based Spectacle Entertainment say they hope to start construction this year on currently vacant land along Interstate 8094 and open the new casino on December 31st, 2020. The Times reports the Gary Plan Commission voted unanimously Tuesday to approve the casino project. Spectacle's plans include building a hotel and parking garage within 2 or 3 years. Spectacle reached a deal this month to switch from the current Majestic Star Casino names to Hard Rock Casino, Gary. Spectacle Vice President John Keeler says Hard Rock's management of the casino will help it compete with planned new Chicago casinos. Spectacle Vice President John Keeler says Hard Rock's management of the casino will help it compete with planned new Chicago casinos.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A man accused of abusing calves at an Indiana dairy farm that's a popular agritourism destination is in federal immigration custody. Newton County Jail officers transferred 36-year-old Edgar Gardoza Vasquez to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody on July 19th after he posted bond. Gardoza Vasquez is one of 3 former Fair Oaks Farms employees accused of abusing calves at the Newton County farm. They were charged with felony torturing or mutilating a vertebrate animal and misdemeanor animal cruelty after an animal rights group released undercover video showing calves being thrown, kicked, and otherwise abused by workers.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Navy is planning to commission its new USS Indianapolis combat vessel at a Northwest Indiana port this fall. The ceremony, marking the ship's entry into the Navy's active fleet, is set for October 26th at Burns Harbor along Lake Michigan. It is the fourth military vessel carrying the Indianapolis name. The second USS Indianapolis was sunk by a Japanese submarine in July 1945 while returning from a Pacific island where it delivered key components for the Hiroshima atomic bomb. Only 317 of its nearly 1,200 crewmen survived the sinking and days in shark-infested waters. The ship was built at a Marinette, Wisconsin shipyard and will be based near Jacksonville, Florida. It is a Freedom-class littoral ship designed to be highly maneuverable for missions such as mine clearing and anti-submarine warfare.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
ArcelorMittal has been fined $14,000 after a steel worker died in an April train accident at the company's Indiana Harbor Steel Mill in Northwest Indiana. The Times reports the Indiana Department of Labor, Occupational Health and Safety Administration found two serious safety violations at the East Chicago Mill, including failing to, quote, establish and maintain conditions of work which were reasonably safe and healthful for employees. State inspectors suggested ArcelorMittal follow rail safety procedures and boost training. ArcelorMittal spokesman William Steer says the company has robust programs in place for safety. He says the company is working to resolve the citations. Officials have said 49-year-old Edwin L. Fleming of Cherville died when the engine he was operating struck a rail car on an adjacent track in a raw materials field.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
In a special meeting that lasted about 3 minutes, the St. John Town Council on Tuesday voted to award a controversial $188,000 in bonus money to municipal employees, including $25,000 to town manager Steve Kill. Monday's special meeting was a little bit longer because, unlike on Tuesday, the residents who packed the town hall were allowed to comment. Monday's meeting ended in a 4-1 vote for the first reading of the bonus ordinance. The Post Tribune reports Tuesday's vote to pass the ordinance on a final reading was slightly different at 3-1-1 as Councilwoman Libby Popovich, one of the four who voted in favor of the ordinance on Monday, abstained from Tuesday's vote. The only board member to vote against the ordinance at both meetings was Gerald Swetz. Council members Mark Barony, Michael Forbes, and Rose Hedge voted in favor of the ordinance each time. The meetings were only scheduled for Monday and Tuesday because the Indiana State Board of Accounts, after being contacted by resident Joe Hero, said a motion made at the council's regular meeting on July 11th to grant Kill the $25,000 was not sufficient. Bonuses of $10,000 are also being given to Police Chief James Kefton, Fire Chief Fred Willman, and Building and Planning Director Rick Elberly. Several other employees are set to get $2,500 to $5,000, with others at $1,000 or $500. Immediately following the vote, many residents loudly voiced their frustration about the bonuses being awarded without allowing them to comment publicly. Resident Julie Stevens said she was hoping to speak at the podium to voice her, quote, absolute shock that the council, with the exception of Sweats, is in favor of awarding a $25,000 bonus to Kill and the bonus to Kefton, who collectively, since she has been a resident for 1 year, has cost the town a lot of money for legal representation, missed opportunities for road improvement grants, and investing town money in projects that seem to be stalled. Stevens said she is also disappointed that longtime councilman Barony and Forbes did not know the correct procedure to award the bonuses. Sweats, who called for public comment successfully on Monday but was denied when he did so on Tuesday, said the whole process, quote, is, quote, making a mockery of what the voters of our town expect and have asked for. Overall, about 30 residents submitted letters to Clerk Treasurer Beth Hernandez voicing their disapproval about the process.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Authorities say a possible police impersonator may have stopped two female motorists in Northwest Indiana in recent weeks. Indiana State Police say a motorist was stopped on southbound I-65 near Crown Point the night of July 8th by a man in a black or dark blue Ford Crown Victoria with red and blue lights inside. She told State Police the man didn't identify himself as an officer and yelled at her for allegedly speeding. The motorist says the man took her driver's license and registration back to his car and told her she'd be mailed a ticket. Separately, the Portage Police Department says a motorist reported being stopped by a similar vehicle July 17th. State Police released a sketch of a suspect and are seeking tips from the public.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The former president of the Indianapolis Teachers Union pleaded guilty Monday in federal court. From the Indiana Public Broadcasting's Education Desk, Eric Weddle reports the FBI and local law enforcement found widespread misuse of teachers' dues.
Rondalyn Cornett pleaded guilty in the Southern District Court of Indiana for embezzling more than $100,000. Cornett was the president of the Indianapolis Education Association. The labor group negotiates salaries for teachers in the Indianapolis Public Schools District. Prosecutors say Cornett treated the union's bank account as her own for years, writing checks and using a debit card for personal expenses. She now faces up to 20 years in jail and fines. A year ago, the Indiana State Teachers Association investigated Cornett following a complaint. Their findings led to criminal charges. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Rolls-Royce announced a new partnership with Purdue University at the CyberTech Midwest Conference in Indianapolis Wednesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports they're partnering to develop better training techniques to improve cybersecurity.
During a speech at the CyberTech Midwest Conference, Rolls-Royce Defense Programs President Phil Burkholder announced the new partnership with Purdue. He says to truly protect against cyber threats, businesses and governments need to train employees to be the first line of defense.
Well, our choice is to be aware, and part of that awareness, we believe, is to train every one of our employees.
Burkholder says Rolls-Royce and Purdue are working on a formal agreement with the state of Indiana to share these techniques with businesses statewide. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state has chosen its first round of recipients for money from the Volkswagen settlements. Indiana received more than $40 million to reduce the state's diesel emissions after the company violated the Clean Air Act. In the first round, $9 million will pay for nearly 180 vehicles in 23 counties. That includes two electric transit buses, each for the cities of Fort Wayne and Gary, as well as one electric bus for Bartholomew Consolidated Schools, Monroe County Community Schools, Delphi Community Schools, and Carmel Clay Schools. The committee that approved the awards got requests for nearly three times as much money as what the state had to spend this round. The state will start receiving proposals for its next round of awards under the Volkswagen settlement in October.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana has distributed $300,000 to food banks across the state. The funding, which was set aside in the new two-year state budget passed earlier this year, could help organizations purchase and distribute fresh, healthy food options to people in their areas. 11 Indiana food banks will receive the money to support programs that include pantries and mobile sites. More than 13% of Hoosiers are food insecure.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana nonprofit is touring the state to bring opioid education and tools to faith-based communities. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the efforts.
Overdose Lifeline will visit seven different faith organizations across the state. Executive Director Justin Phillips says churches have been asking how to engage their community regarding the opioid epidemic.
armed with information, they'll have a solution. We had a gentleman say to us the other day, I don't know how to help. So we feel like these regional trainings are opportunities to give them the tools to help.
The sessions provide information on how the crisis has impacted the state and program training to prevent and respond to addiction. Overdose Lifeline partnered with the Indiana State Department of Health and Indiana University's Prevention Insights to offer the workshops. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana House and Senate Republican leadership want to insert themselves into a federal lawsuit against Attorney General Curtis Hill and the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the lawsuit involves Hill's alleged groping last year of a state lawmaker and three legislative staffers.
The four women filed a federal lawsuit earlier this year. They accused Curtis Hill of sexual harassment and battery, and they accused the state of employment discrimination. That includes sexist or inappropriate comments allegedly made by lawmakers of both parties. House and Senate GOP leaders hired an outside attorney and want to intervene in the lawsuit. They argue the three staffers are their employees, and so the two chambers have a right to defend themselves against some of the accusations in the suit. They also say Attorney General Hill, whose office normally represents the legislature in court, has a conflict of interest in this case and shouldn't be allowed to speak for the General Assembly. According to documents filed with the court, the legislative leaders deny most of the women's allegations regarding employment discrimination. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Nearly a dozen presidential candidates will be in Indianapolis this week for the National Urban League's annual conference. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the civil rights organization's theme for this year's event is a focus on racial equality.
Former Vice President Joe Biden, Senators Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Kamala Harris, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg are among the Democratic presidential candidates slated to speak at the National Urban League Conference. League President Mark Morial says he wants to hear the candidates address what he calls some of America's stubborn problems.
How we ensure that every child is educated, the difficulties of the income and wealth gap between blacks and whites in America. I think that's what our people want to hear about.
But Morial says the candidates' words at the conference aren't the only thing they'll be judged on.
Have they been there on those issues over their career? Or is this just campaign rhetoric?
This is the first time in 25 years the league will hold its conference in Indiana. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Temperatures are soaring, and that means Midwesterners are headed to summer fairs and festivals. They'll eat plenty of high-calorie foods, from corn dogs to fried ice cream sandwiches. But Side Effects Public Media's Isaiah Seibert reports that some festivals are trying to include healthier foods.
The annual Romp Fest attracts some of the biggest names in bluegrass. Over 25,000 fans come to a park in western Kentucky to listen to and make music. And whenever they get hungry, they can walk over to a makeshift food court where they'll find Sandra Mendez's truck.
We are Fresh by Jeans. As the name implies, we are fresh food.
Specialties include brisket grilled cheese sandwiches and vegan Chipotle burrito bowls. It's mostly organic, locally grown ingredients. No fried food here.
We lovingly call our menu healthy drunk food. It's what you would want to eat when you're drunk, but feel like, gosh, I'm going to pay for this tomorrow. So it's safe to eat when you're drunk.
And she says a lot of people are eating it.
We get young and old, but definitely the millennial crowd and younger flock to us.
Healthy food and wide appeal. That's what festival organizer Carly Smith looks for in vendors as she combs through more than 100 applications.
One thing we've always strived to be conscious of here at Romp is to have some farm-to-table fresh foods, offer some vegetarian options, even vegan options, and especially local options showcasing our barbecue heritage here in Owensboro.
The festival thinks about the food the same way it thinks about the music, with the big tent philosophy.
Our mission is to preserve bluegrass history, but also we want to grow the music. You know, you can't just stay in one spot.
But not all festival organizers approach food through the same lens.
we've known through the years that folks like to come to the fair to splurge and have a good time.
That's Sharon Smith, spokesperson for the Indiana State Fair. When it opens in early August, visitors can snack on French fries topped with chicken, cheese sauce, buffalo sauce, blue cream, ranch dressing, bacon bits, and chives, or vanilla ice cream sandwiched between two chocolate chip cookies dipped in funnel cake batter and deep fried, and garnished with powdered sugar and chocolate sauce. Smith says that's what fairgoers want.
They may not be thinking entirely about their waistline. They're thinking about what tastes good, what's refreshing.
There are some vegetables.
A lot of them are on the fried side, but some of them aren't.
And there are a few vegan or vegetarian items. Corn on the cob hold the butter, baked potato hold the bacon, French fries hold the white meat chicken on top. You get the idea. Some state fairs, like Iowa's and Nebraska's, list healthy food items or vendors on their website. Indiana's doesn't, but even without that information, there are ways to eat healthy.
If you do get a fried option, you're most likely there with a friend. I always encourage try to split it because the portion size is probably so big anyway that that's a really good idea.
That's Alyssa Schroeder, a clinical dietitian. She has tips for people who want to watch what they eat.
There's a lot of tempting fried options, but typically most of the places you can also find some grilled options.
She's noticed more people interested in eating healthy at summer festivals, a good sign in a region where obesity is a stubborn public health problem. In Indiana and most other Midwest states, the adult obesity rate tops 30%. Schroeder says people shouldn't stay at home because they're worried about finding healthy foods.
I would never encourage someone to avoid living life just because they're nervous that there's not a healthy option there. There are ways you can work around that. Don't let your diet control your life.
And it's not the end of the world if you indulge.
If that's the worst that you eat all week, then I say go for it.
In fact, she does it herself.
I'm going to have a fried Snickers this year.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
It's been 1 year since an independent investigator unveiled a detailed report on the Indiana Department of Child Services. That came after a huge spike in children in the system, often linked with the opioid crisis. Since then, the agency has made significant progress. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, some say it's not enough.
In December 2017, then-DCS Director Mary Beth Bonaventura's resignation letter sparked a firestorm. She said Governor Eric Holcomb's leadership would lead to child deaths. What followed were legislative hearings, calls for investigations, and an independent evaluation of the agency. That evaluation produced a report with 57 specific recommendations for the embattled agency, which had Holcomb, at the time, excited.
Because now we have a game plan, a blueprint, or a roadmap, to help us get to where we want to go.
1 year later, Director Terry Stigdon says her agency is very different, moving in the right direction, and still in transition.
So I consider it an aircraft carrier. Sure. I can turn the wheel as fast as I like. It's still only going to move so quickly.
Still, some of the changes were fast. The Holcomb administration poured tens of millions of dollars into the agency last year, and results followed. Staff turnover and average caseloads improved. Other changes, though, couldn't be accomplished as quickly. Perhaps chief among them, a culture of fear. Stigdon says fixing that is ongoing work.
Letting people know it's okay to speak up and that you will be heard will help with identifying if there's something coming. Because at this high level, it'll be a little while before we see it. We need our county folks to be able to speak up safely and clearly and quickly to let us know what they see.
Other changes took time because they required legislation, and that's where Kaya Misha Colom and Joseph Delamater were involved. Colom and Delamater are foster parents, and a couple years ago, they were planning to adopt their foster son until DCS took him back without warning.
And we lost a child.
Colom and Delamater, both attorneys, worked to give foster parents more rights, and 2019's Senate Bill 1 did just that, including requiring judges to give foster parents a voice in court. Colom says she's already seeing a difference with judges.
Now she took the time right in the courtroom, read it over, asked questions about it, is allowing foster parents to speak up.
Still, Colom uses a big ship comparison, similar to Terry Stigdon's, to describe the pace of change at DCS, arguing it needs to be faster. Christy Cundiff, another foster parent, uses a different metaphor when talking about Stigdon and DCS.
what she is trying to do is resurrect the Titanic off the ocean floor. And that's a difficult job. I don't know of anybody that can do that.
Cundiff heads the advocacy organization Indiana Foster and Adoptive Parents, which counts more than 10,000 members statewide. One of the biggest issues she wants corrected? DCS doesn't find children permanent homes nearly fast enough.
Well, when you have children that have been in care 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 years, we're not moving those children to permanency. So we have to pull the stopper out of the bathtub, per se.
Della Motter, who works child welfare cases, has something that could help. He says every child in the system needs a lawyer. And that's the subject of a recent class action lawsuit against DCS. And while not everyone thinks the lawsuits are a good thing, Republican Senator Aaron Houchin does. Houchin, who used to be a caseworker, is a leading voice in the General Assembly on child welfare. And she sounds optimistic when talking about the future.
I feel confident that the leadership that we have will continue to work with the General Assembly and other stakeholders to implement changes that will make kids more safe.
But that optimism is not universal. Just ask Della Motter.
I don't think that we have seen enough lasting and positive change to be able to have confidence.
One thing everyone agrees on, the work is far from over. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Ken Page, psychotherapist, host of the Deeper Dating podcast, and author of the bestseller, Deeper Dating and Discover the Power of Intimacy, discussed how people can improve their well-being by improving their love relationship with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Here's the conversation.
You suggest that people improve their well-being by improving their love relationship.
I would even say their relationships overall, and particularly like their love relationships, either finding love or keeping love. And I've got is all about connections, work-life balance, and quality of life.
And so tell me a little bit about that. How are people's relationships so impactful on their overall well-being? People are encouraged to do some maintenance and make sure that their relationships are in a good place.
Yeah, I think for all of us, it is a wonderful thing to do, a kind of check on how our relationships are doing. Because that's something, just like we need to look at our budget and we need to look at budget's a really good example, or our health and how that's doing. We need to look at our mental health and how that's doing. And the focus this year, which is the 90th anniversary of Mental Health Month, which is a wonderful concept to kind of bring awareness to people of the importance of taking care of their mental health. And this year, the theme's all about connections and quality of life and work-life balance. And connections, including connections with pets, romantic relationships, friendships, family relationships, all those things. The research is in, and it's overwhelmingly clear. The quality of our connections is just about the number absolute one most important factor affecting mental health. And, you know, with that, the quality of your spousal relationship is absolutely one of the biggest determinants of your quality of life. So I just want to say that for everyone who is in a relationship, improving that relationship might be the best thing you can do for your quality of life and mental health. And people who are looking for a relationship, if you can make some changes in the way you're looking for love, your chances of finding it become dramatically better. So those are just two big things I want to say about this. But just to kind of frame out the bigger picture of the importance of connection, there are amazing, amazing studies out there that just say kind of shocking news. Like, there was one study that involved over 300,000 participants. What they looked at was social indicators of social connection, like the size of your social network, your feeling of having social support, things like that, like your sense of being connected. And they did this with over 300,000 participants. And here's what they found. If you score low on these indicators of social connection, you had a similar risk of mortality as you would have if you smoked up to 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do they make that connection?
Well, I think that the level of stress that you experience, that might maybe leads to inflammation, and just, you know, we know that there's a huge connection between stress and physical health, as well as stress and mental health. And so though it hurts us, and we are beings that are wired for connection. When we are isolated, when we are lonely, it leads to just a tremendous amount of actual pain. I'll never forget, living in New York City, there was a couple below me. They seemed to bicker a lot. They weren't so happy. They were an elderly couple. And the woman passed away. Maybe 3 months after that, I get a knock on my door. And I go to the door, and it's the gentleman, a very previously kind of elegant guy. He was in his pajamas. And he looked at me with this, a very together guy. He looked at me with the most haunted eyes, standing there in his pajamas, and he said, "I'm so lonely. I can't bear it." He had never spoken to me that in like a decade of living above him.
Wow.
And it just hit me. And as a psychotherapist and as someone who works in this field, I know that the pain of disconnectedness is huge. It's huge. And there's tons and tons of research that shows again and again and again that people who are in satisfying spousal relationships feel happier, have fewer problems with health, and live longer. This has been proven again and again. So this is a very important thing that we can do for our well-being, is create better social connection, including, I have to say, connection with animals, because that's a great and wonderful thing. But also, if you're someone who wants a relationship or you're someone who's in a relationship, that's something to focus on, because it really matters, and it matters for your well-being.
What are some of the ways people in love relationships can improve those relationships? And then I'd like to also know, what are some of the ways single people can find authentic love? If you want to do the first question first.
Sure. Having a happy spousal relationship is a huge, huge deal. In fact, some research has even showed that it's more important than any other element, including physical health, for determining the quality of your well-being in the world. And we know that's true. When we're with our partner and there's not a sense of communication, there's not a sense of safety, it hurts. We feel it. We shut down. We close down. We feel angry. We pull into ourselves. We get bitter. It affects us. And when we're in a relationship where there's a sense of love and acceptance, in a basic way, you get to share things, you get to have fun together, you have shared values, you have shared things that you love. Life is just, the ride is easier. The ride of life is just easier and smoother and more pleasurable, because the medium that we need to live in is a medium of connection. That's how we're built. It's how we're wired. And interesting, John Gottman, who's a wonderful researcher in the field of spousal relationships, did a study of couples that succeeded and couples that failed. And he found out that there's actually a ratio of positive to negative interactions. So he would look at couples and he would see how many of their interactions were positive. And included in positive is an ability to listen. Your partner reaches out to you about whatever, the dishes, something he or she saw on the internet, something the kids did, something that happened down the street, anything. When you miss that moment because you're focused on something else, that's what's called a lost bid. That's considered a kind of negative interaction, because your partner raised up hope and you dropped the ball. So that's an example of a certain kind of negative interaction. Of course, other ones are, and this is the killer, disdainful communication. That's the most toxic of all. But abusive communication, critical communication, all those kind of things, those are all under the category of negative interactions. Positive interactions are you catch the ball when your partner throws it. You listen. You don't judge them. You express interest. You express curiosity. You validate the good things about them. You tell them you're behind them. You tell them you've got this. You tell them what you love about them. Those are all kind of positive interactions. Even just ones that are not verbal, but are that you do the dishes or you rub their back or whatever. Well, there's a ratio of positive to negative interactions that will forecast incredibly well whether a couple's going to make it or not make it. And here's the ratio. It's 5-1. There's got to be 5 positive interactions to every negative interaction, or your relationship is in jeopardy. So the single biggest thing that you can do to affect your quality of life, in many cases, is affect the quality, enhance the quality of your couplehood. And one way to do that is to increase the positive interactions. You could think in your head, you could actually count and look. Am I 5-1? Is my partner 5-1? How can we get there? What can we do to get there? And I'll tell you one amazing thing you can do to get there. This is a simple thing, and you can find it in any gift shop. And it's a card. But it's not just an I love you card. It's a card with space in it. And what you do is you take that card and you write to your partner the things that you admire about your partner. You actually write that down, the things you admire, the things you depend on, the things you love about them, the things you respect about them, and you just kind of pour it out. You will instantly raise the kind of quality of your relationship by doing that. And that's something that every couple should do. Every time your partner does something that just seems wonderful, not just the typical, you look beautiful, but that's great too, you look handsome, but kind of the things you admire, the things you lean on in your partner, the things that other people love about them, you tell them that and watch what happens. So those are just some examples.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, one other thing that I want to say about this, these are huge kind of tips that make a profound difference in a relationship. Well, Eli Finkel, who's a brilliant researcher in the subject of couplehood, created something that he calls the marriage hack. It's a 21-minute process that is research-proven to help your relationship from deteriorating. It's really interesting what it is. It's really simple, and it's really wonderful. And here's what it is. You and your spouse do this process. And you could just look it up on YouTube, the marriage hack, Eli Finkel, where he explains it in detail. But in essence, what it is that you and your partner both think about, in the year ahead, what do you think is the kind of conflict that's going to bog you down the most? What's the place that kind of gets you the most stuck? What's your trigger point that's kind of the worst? And you think about what that is, and then you each imagine an impartial viewer, a kind of wise, impartial viewer who wants the best for both of you and wants the best for your relationship. You imagine that person, and you imagine that person has like an inside view to the worst of the worst of that, of those problems between the two of you. Inside view to everything. And you imagine, what would this neutral, objective person who's pretty wise and wants the best for you as a couple, what would that person tell you to do? And you write down everything that person would say. Your spouse does it too. And then you read it together, and then you make a pact that those are the things you're going to work on this upcoming year around that situation. You both commit to do that. And what Dr. Finkel shows is that most relationships have a quality of communication that downgrades gradually over the years. What this does, it doesn't upgrade that, but it stops it from downgrading for the year ahead. And that's a big deal because it gives you a leg up with some of the other things I said to actually change your relationship. And the joy that that brings you, the meaning, the gratification is incalculable. So these suggestions, take them on, try them out. They will change your relationship in significant ways, and that'll change your sense of well-being, and that improves your mental health.
Thank you so much, Ken. We'll definitely explore the other recommendations that you have for single people on our next conversation, but really appreciate your sharing good insights and advice with us on Mental Health Month and how to improve your well-being through relationships.
Thank you so much, Sharon. It is always a delight to be interviewed by you, so thanks for the opportunity.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Donna Stuckert.
Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District has been busy trying to educate people about not only the usual recyclables, but also about such things as household hazardous waste, and also, too, about smoke detectors. And to find out the latest, let's talk to Donna Stuckey. She's the public education coordinator for the Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And Donna, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Smoke detectors are something that probably most people don't think about possibility of being recyclable, but I guess they are technically if they're handled properly. And tell us how the district based out of Valparaiso has been doing it.
Yes, well, we've marked our one-year anniversary for recycling smoke detectors. We launched this program in July of last year. And we're working in partnership with a lot of different fire departments to collect smoke detectors from residents. And we send it to a company that takes the radioactive material and sends it to a special waste fill so that that radioactive material, and it's very small amount, but it this way it's handled appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest, the metal and the plastic from the smoke detector itself, is recycled with other plastics and metals with that company. So before we had this in place, we did not have a way to recycle smoke detectors. And many times people would call us knowing that there's radioactive material in smoke detectors and asking us what they should do with it. And we basically told them, send it back to the company. But many companies couldn't really tell us what they would do with those smoke detectors
yeah.
once they got them or if they handled them appropriately. And personally, years ago, I called First Alert and they basically said, I'll just throw it away because it's such a small amount of radioactive material. It's not going to be a big deal.
Well, that's not a very good idea anyway, I suppose.
No.
And also, too, that there's also a problem, too, I guess, if you did happen to throw it in the trash, if you put it, even if you buried it in trash bags and threw that in your trash can, when the collection truck comes by on its regular route to pick up your trash, it's not a very good way to handle it anyway.
No, the radioactive material is safe if it's in the smoke detectors, but it becomes compromised when it's crushed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in the trash business, everything is crushed. I mean, you have the trucks that go by and they crush your trash in order to make room for more. So
yeah.
Because they've got an entire route that they have to fit in there. And then you have at the transfer stations, the semi trucks that get that basically get filled to the rim with trash to take to the landfill. And the only way they can get as much as they can in those trucks is by crushing it down. And then of course at the landfill they make room for more trash, so they're running it over and running it over with these bulldozers to make more room to add more trash. So, and that's when the radioactive material becomes compromised, and it can be a problem for the environment. So that's what we really want to get control of by offering this recycling program.
Now, I understand in Porter County there are a number of locations where people can bring their expired smoke detectors to get them recycled. Tell us about those spots.
Yes. Well, yes, there are quite a few locations, as a matter of fact. We have a bunch of fire departments that are working with us, like the Chesterton Fire Department at 702 Broadway, the Porter Fire Department, 550 Beam Street, the Valparaiso Fire Department, Station 2, 2605 Cumberland Drive, the Ogden Dunes Fire Department, 111 Hillcrest Road, Lakes of the Four Seasons Volunteer Fire Force, that's 10645 Randolph Street, the South Haven Fire Department, 398 West 700 North, Valparaiso, the Hebron Fire Department, 109 North Washington, and Porter EMS Station Number 3, 453 West State Road 8 in Hebron.
Mm-hmm.
And if all else fails, If you're not near any of those or if it's not convenient to go there, drop them off at any of the compost sites, the public compost sites. And we have Valparaiso, the Boone Grove compost site, and now we have the Portage compost site, which will also accept expired smoke detectors.
And we should mention, we've been talking here about the smoke detectors, in particular the ones that have the radioactive material that is used to help detect the smoke in the air. But we're not talking about carbon monoxide detectors. And those are okay, I understand, to recycle in not necessarily the regular recyclables, but the special stuff.
Exactly. Regular carbon monoxide detectors can be recycled with our electronics program. And we have a number of places throughout Porter County that accepts all electronics, whether it be a carbon monoxide detector, a vacuum cleaner, a computer, a television, a cell phone. They can bring those to either the Valparaiso or Boone Grove compost sites. And in addition, the Portage Street Department is also accepting electronics.
Of course, the district also handles what is referred to in the business as household hazardous waste. And we have some collection days coming up soon, don't we?
Oh, yes. We've got the last three collections of the year. So If you are out there, residents of Porter County, and you've got some pesticides or some chemicals or things in your garage that you've been meaning to get rid of, there are three more collections where we will accept them. And one of them is in Hebron, and it's this weekend at Hebron Middle/High School. And we have another one coming up the following weekend at Portage High School. And those collections run 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And, of course, the last collection of the year, which you don't want to miss if you've got these chemicals in your garage, in your sheds, in your basement, is to come to the Porter County Fairgrounds on October 12th, and we will take those chemicals off your hands. And in most cases, these materials are recycled, and if not, they are disposed of properly so they aren't an issue for the environment.
Now, we've talked here about the special recycling issues that have to be handled. And, of course, you have the drop-off sites out in Porter County that people can take advantage of. But there have been problems going back even into last year with some of the regular recycling drop-off locations in Porter County. Bring us up to date on how the situation is with the drop-off sites. And maybe we need a little lesson here on how to properly recycle stuff at the drop-off sites, too.
Well, we have six drop-off sites in Porter County where people can take what we call their curbside recyclables.
Mm-hmm.
So if people don't have access to curbside recycling, we're talking people that live in condos or apartments, or maybe they have a cart and it's always overflowing, they can bring those items to our drop-off sites. So these are items like paper, your plastic tubs, jugs, bottles, and jars, your cartons, your glass bottles and jars, and those kind of items, your cardboard boxes. So they're normal recyclable things that you would recycle curbside. And what we have found is that there are a number of people that I don't know if they think that by leaving things on the ground that they're going to be recycled, which they won't.
Mm-hmm.
So we still find that people are leaving stuff on the ground, and whether it's in plastic bags or whether it's items that are inappropriate. Somebody recently left six office chairs.
Oh, my goodness.
So
that's what places like the Restore and the resale shops are for.
Exactly, exactly. There's so many places in Porter County where these items can be taken and somebody else can use them. And if people don't know that, all they need to do is call us at 465-3694 and tell us what they're looking to get rid of and we can advise them on places that are appropriate for reuse, you know, rather than throwing it in the garbage if it still can be reused. And I think other people look at it as, well, this object has plastic in it, so, you know, we'll just take it there and they can take the plastic off of it and it'll be recycled. And that's not necessarily the case either.
No.
These boxes at the beginning of the year were changed out with smaller holes so that the materials need to be put in the holes and anything that's left on the ground is not necessarily recycled and is more than likely thrown away because our employees aren't going to rummage through bags because they don't know what's in there. And it could be material, you know, people get poked with syringes and needles and broken glass. So leaving things on the ground isn't the best way to deal with them.
And I imagine, too, that even the company that that the Solid Waste District has to pick up the materials in the drop-off site boxes is going to assume, just as you all have to, that whatever's on the ground is considered trash. And what's going to happen is, oh, maybe it'll get picked up. It'll get picked up by a trash truck. But the idea is that it means it's going to be charged to the district as trash rather than as recyclable material.
That's right. And what has happened is because of what happened with China last year, and China was our biggest consumer for recycled materials. Up to 30-40% of our materials used to go to the country of China. And China has decided that we are really, really bad recyclers. And we have been giving them a lot of trash mixed in with the product that they're buying, and they've decided they don't want to buy it from us anymore. So we as a country have to learn to become better recyclers so that we create a product that companies want and that there's a demand for. And there's no demand for, you know, giant bales of plastic with dirty diapers in there,
yeah.
or things that are inappropriate, toys and other stuff that's in there that people have just assumed, well, I'll throw it in the recycle bin, and somebody somewhere down the line will figure out if it's recyclable or not.
Yeah.
So we really need the consumers, we need residents to make that decision early in the process so that we create a product and companies will buy it, and we go through the recycle process so that we preserve our natural resources.
I was reading something the other day, too, and maybe you've seen it as well, too, that some people just assume, and for example, with plastics recycling, that you used to go by the arrows and the numbers, 1, 2, 3, whatever number it is, on the bottom of the container, and you could almost always assume that it was going to be made with that particular material. But nowadays, the plastics are getting all mixed together. The polymers are not the same, and so what may be marked as a number 2 or a number 3 may have something rather exotic in it, mixed in to make the product to begin with. And that in turn is going to make it even more difficult, if not impossible, to recycle.
Yes, exactly. So we tell people to not go by that symbol. Over the years, people assume that if it has the quote-unquote recycle symbol, that they can put it in their bin. But that is not the case. Because what is recyclable here isn't necessarily recyclable anywhere else, in Minneapolis or Indianapolis or in Florida. So those symbols are only to identify the type of material it is and not the recyclability of it, because the markets are different throughout the United States. So we tell people, as far as plastics go, it's safe to recycle tubs, jugs, bottles, and jars. And anything else, if you're in doubt, throw it away.
Yeah.
Because it's better not to compromise the rest of the plastics than to put it in the recycle bin, and it's much better being in your trash instead.
I've been trying, even though I don't always find it this way because so much stuff is in plastic containers these days, I have been looking purposely for things that are made with glass jars and and trying to recycle, because those are always recyclable. As long as they're clean, they can go in the recycling container and they'll be taken up, and they'll be a good end user for that someplace. It's always pretty good, as long as it's clean to work to begin with here. So I do my best to try to watch out for things, but it's difficult, and we know. And if, as always, Donna, if anybody has questions, if we maybe need another primer on what to put in the recycling drop-off containers, give us the number so, or the way that people can contact you folks at the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction Office.
Oh, absolutely. Please call us at 465-3694. We are your solid waste district, and we can guide you when you're out there and you're confused on the different materials and the different products out there, because there are a lot and there's so many. And recycling isn't black and white, unfortunately. There's so many gray areas because of the different products. And we also have some tips and guidelines online. So you can visit our website at portercountyrecycling.org, and we're always happy to help.
And, of course, our friends that live in Lake County and the surrounding counties with their respective recycling districts, they can check their own particular recycling district website and find out the same information, too, because it's all the same. We're all in this big boat together, I guess, when it comes to having the right kind of materials to go out for recycling, to be sure. Donna, thank you for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Donna Stuckert is the Public Education Coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.